everybody. I'm Kevin Witham. Welcome to Season 4 of the Common Grounds Unity Podcast. Jesus prayed for unity so that the world may believe. Our mission is to connect and gather with Christians outside one's family of churches because we believe unity starts by building relationships. We say unity starts with a cup of coffee. So grab a cup and let's get started with another conversation.
Welcome back, everybody, to Common Grounds Unity Podcast. And like every week, we have a fantastic perspective to share with you, amazing story, a new way to look at things. And we are glad that you're with us on this journey. So I'm going to introduce Drew, our co-host, and let him kind of introduce our guest, and we'll get started. And we look forward to our time together today.
Well, glad to be here, Tina. Tina is in Poland right now. I'm in North Carolina. Mark is in Abilene. Our guest today, really excited about, Mark Hamilton. I'll read you this bio, then I'm going to share just a little bit about what I really admire about Mark. So after ministering several years in congregations in Connecticut and Massachusetts, Mark moved to Abilene Christian University in 2000. There, he teaches courses in biblical Hebrew and Old Testament. Mark is author of more than 200 articles, chapters in books, and reviews. He's also written or edited 12 books and is currently working on several more, including commentaries on Genesis and 1st and 2nd Samuel. He also frequently preaches and teaches in churches. Welcome, Mark. So one of the things that I love about Mark is in the MDiv, we were doing a survey of the Old Testament, and it was very challenging to me. There was a lot in that class that challenged me, but the thing that kept me engaged and kept me reading was Mark, because I could see in him a love for God that is far beyond where I was, and a love for God's word, which was also far beyond where I was. And I said, this man who knows scripture very well, he knows all these challenges of interpretation and history, and yet he loves God incredibly, and he loves God's word. And that just really carried me through a very challenging time in my spiritual growth. So I'm very thankful for Mark personally. I'm thankful for what you have done in your scholarship and what you have done to give voice to issues like we're talking about today. And the book that we're talking about today is called Jesus, King of Strangers. And it talks about what the Bible really says about immigration. So welcome, Mark. Anything you want to share with us as we get started?
Well, first of all, thank you for the invitation to be part of this. I'm really grateful for that because, one, I'm glad to reconnect with you, Drew, and I'm glad to meet Tina and to get to know you better, but also because this is an important topic. It affects the lives of millions and millions of people. And so it's important that we talk about it. And also it's important because it seems that the church in the United States particularly could do a lot better. We have a lot of work to do and we need to do it well. So I'm grateful to be here today.
Yeah, I'd like to encourage our listeners that do any work in their local community with refugees or immigrants or have any connection, if your church partners with ministries that do this kind of work, this book is really, really important. I've done this kind of work a really long time, and there were so many ways, Mark, that as I read it, it just shifted my understanding. So, like, we can feel a lot of ways about the issue of refugees and immigrants, but when that is really strengthened by what scripture says or really challenged, like in that way, it's really important. And so I think this is really accessible. It is scholarly, but it's also super practical. So I'm really excited and encourage our listeners to read this and engage with other people around the themes of this book. And I'm glad that we're going to talk a little bit about the Abraham and Sarah story, because that, like, from the beginning of the book, it just totally turned everything. I had not looked at their story in the way that the book shares about that. So I'm really excited for us to talk about that. But what was behind you feeling the need to write this?
Well, there are two sides of it. Part of it is my own experience, because My wife is an immigrant. I have many friends who are immigrants. My children are the children of an immigrant. So part of it's very personal. And on the other hand, when I went to church, the language I heard taken for granted not only demeaned those people repeatedly, but showed no awareness of the biblical text or the Christian tradition. I mean, the disconnect between what I heard in church and what I read in the Bible was so stark that I felt I had to write a book. And so I've written other books, as Drew says. I've never written any of them with the same kind of existential push that I did this one. And maybe that shows and maybe it doesn't. But I think part of it is you want to get this right. And I think we're not getting it right. So those are some of the reasons, at least. You shouldn't write a book in anger, but it's hard not to sometimes.
Yeah, when it affects people you love, it is hard and maybe not even desirable to be disengaged emotionally.
I think that's right.
Appropriate emotional connection. So you first wrote this 2019, I guess leading up to 2019, you know, very heated time. We are again in a heated time. Every time political debates and elections come along, we get very divided. And I think you bring a lot of clarity into a lot of these issues that we divide over and provide us some ways to talk about it. But one of the things that I found very interesting, and this is a little going off to the side a little bit, but in your book, you talk about the Westphalian system that developed in 1648. A lot of the times we assume that the way things are now is the way things always were. But can you talk a little about what did migration look like before that pivot and what it's become after that?
Well, sure. I mean, in one sense, that's a very dry subject, but I think it's important because we, as you say, we assume that the way we do things now are the way they've always been done. Now, some things have stayed the same. You know, countries have had borders for 5,000 years, and they've patrolled those borders to a certain degree. But other things have changed. For example, the fact that everybody is a citizen of a country is a modern phenomenon. The fact that you have a passport if you want to go from one country to another, unless your country has some kind of deal with that country that so you don't have to, like in the European Union. Those are all modern phenomena. The fact that you would be an official in one country and not in others is modern, right? Before that, if you were smart enough and connected enough, maybe you will be a high official in one country and another country poaches you, the way we do CEOs of companies today. So that has changed. The idea, and of course, the system, we call it Westphalian because after the Peace of Westphalia that ended the 30 Years' War, the last war of religion in Europe, except the one in Northern Ireland, or the one in former Yugoslavia, almost the last religion war in Europe. That peace began a series of changes about how countries relate to each other that culminated really in the mid-20th century. So that now, you know, everybody's in a country, there's no stateless person, you can't be made stateless under international law, and the subject of one state and not another, generally speaking. That's all very modern. So when people moved around in the past, they moved for some of the same reasons we move today, but there's no process for receiving them in a new country, right? You're not legalized in a new country. You're not naturalized in a new country in the past. These are all modern assumptions. And so that's worth thinking about, that citizenship is a modern construct. That doesn't make it bad, or it doesn't mean we should scrap it. It just means that we should know that these are not Torah from Sinai, right? These are not God-given ways of doing things. That's a long-winded answer to an excellent question. But I think it is important to start with, what are my assumptions and are they right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It gets to, why do we define humans the way we define them? It hasn't always been that case.
Well, and as we may talk about this more later, but as Christians, and I'm writing the book for Christians, not for policymakers, right, though some of them, of course, are Christians, and so they might think about some things. But as Christians, we start with the assumption that we are all God's creation, that every human life has dignity because God gave it dignity. And therefore, to reduce the dignity of another human being is a very grave act, right? It's a defiance of the will of God, to put it pretty starkly. And it's a betrayal of our most fundamental understanding, that we are in solidarity with our fellow human beings in our sin and in our potential for redemption. So Christians, I think we have to start there, not with the other ways we segment the human species.
It's interesting, when the war in Ukraine started, and having worked in different contexts of where people were fleeing war or displaced by war, a lot of workers were amazed at the fact that all of a sudden the United States was all for these particular refugees because they were white. You could see the difference in how people in America saw a white middle class person who was fleeing war versus someone in Africa or someone in Asia. So that was a stark way of seeing how we see the other. If people look like us, it's easier for us to behave in a more biblical way toward them than if we label them the other. And as I was thinking about our responses, the thing that strikes me the most is the way that we view the government's role in taking care of refugees as somehow that absolves us as people of faith from doing anything with refugees.
Well, it's a great question, and I think part of it is a lot of us operate with incorrect knowledge, right? People assume that we spend huge amounts of our federal budget on foreign aid, which isn't true. Non-military foreign aid is a tiny, tiny fraction of the federal budget. Part of it must be the way network information. So, for example, I'm doing the professor thing where I add stuff to the question before I get to the answer. I'm sorry. But I think, you know, we hear about Ukraine for a while, though people seem to be getting tired of it. We've heard almost nothing about the fact that in Sudan there are 6 million refugees, right? You have to dig way down into the news media to find that. You have to listen to European news to find it, actually. And so you can say it's racialist understandings of the world. Part of it is that Ukraine is in Europe, and it's connected economically and militarily to American alliances. The difference is not straightforwardly racist. It's more complicated, but it has to do with the way we communicate, at least in part. So what's the answer is, I think we should know facts better. We should know what actually happens. And you know, if you are a refugee in the United States, you talk about free housing and job. What you get free housing for what, 90 days, something like that, right? So it's, if I lost everything and moved to a country where I might not speak the language, and in 90 days I've got to be up and running, that's pretty tough, I think. I wonder how many of us would survive that. So part of it's lack of information. I was told a story by a friend of mine who's a lawyer and teaches immigration law, that he was talking about a legal case in which a refugee appealed for refugee status in the United States on the basis of persecution in a foreign country as a Christian. And the judge's question was, name the 12 apostles. And when he couldn't name the 12 apostles, the judge said, well, you're obviously not a Christian, because all Christians can name the name of the 12 apostles. And therefore, his asylum request was denied. Well, I think the story is true. I have no reason to doubt the story. But I wonder what percentage of U.S. Christians can name all the 12 apostles. I wonder how many of us would have to leave the country because we couldn't name them. So we need to be more aware of what really happens and stop the stereotyping. But now, finally, to your question. I mean, how do we cultivate empathy with other human beings? It seems like we're so locked in to our animuses and our fears that we're losing our ability to have empathy with people who aren't our blood kin or our oldest friends. So we've got this perfect storm of tangled up issues, and I don't know how to still the storm or unravel the issues, but I think at least we can name them, and then maybe we can start.
thinking about this storm that we're in, of all of this stuff going on, what are some of the questions surrounding immigration that as Christians we should be asking, and where would we typically go for those answers? And maybe what are some more helpful sources that will help us to wrestle with the complexities of these issues?
Well, I think that, I mean, there's several layers of that, right? One, we could just learn the data, you know, which the UNHCR puts out, or the U.S. government put out. They're great at gathering data, crunching the numbers, and then putting it forward in ways that make sense. I mean, the UNHCR makes an annual report and has, I think, since basically the end of World War II. Because another thing is we should make some basic distinctions, right? The UN makes these, the governments make this distinction between among refugees, right? People who cross a border to escape a country, their country of origin, right? Internally displaced people who don't cross a border but move from their home but are forcibly displaced within their country. And then immigration, which is voluntary, more or less. Of course, it's not easy. Those categories, it's good to keep those categories distinct. It's not always easy to keep them distinct because what counts as voluntary, sometimes that's debatable. But if you do those numbers, if you take refugees and internally displaced people, when I started writing the book, UN said there were 50 million. When I finished writing the book, the UN said there were 70 million. Today it says there were 110 million. And that number is only going to go up. And so let's just get some data out there. So that's one thing. Let's read the Bible. We're going to talk about the Bible a bit. As Christians, we should know our history. Christians should know Christian history way better than we do. And we should know the Bible better than we do. And if you read the Bible, there are migrants all over the place. They're not minor characters usually. They're pretty significant characters. Abraham, Moses, I think those count as pretty major characters. Jesus, right? Paul. Now, Jesus and Paul never left the Roman Empire, as far as we know. Paul, maybe when he went to Arabia, maybe that's outside the empire, maybe. But Jesus in Matthew is an internally displaced person, right? He flees persecution and goes to another part of the empire where he's safer. So that seems fairly relevant, I would think. Just one last thing. I think also stories of migrants. Jessica Godot has written a wonderful book about this. And there are other people.
After the Last Border is excellent.
Yeah,
book.
Thank you. It's a wonderful book. And there are other books like that. So I just think some of us deal with issues by numbers. Some of us deal with them by ideas. But most of us deal with them through story. And it's harder to be indifferent to somebody whose story you know. You have to work at it. And unfortunately, people are willing to work at it, but at least we should make it harder for them and ourselves.
There seems to be a lot of times an assumption too that people who are fleeing somewhere, they want to leave. Like they're trying to get somewhere so they can take something from us or take something from others. And I would say anecdotally, the majority of people that I meet, they would rather be in their home, even if it's being bombed, than have to leave. And so the idea that people just want to transplant their whole family to a different country, learn new languages, learn new cultures, try to figure out employment, that somehow they would rather do that than stay in their home country. In this situation between Ukraine and Russia now, where I meet people at the border who, you know, have lived in a city that's been shelled for 18 months, and they finally leave because there's just no place else for them to live. Like everything is destroyed. And I'm like, why in the world would you stay so long? And they're always like, it's my home.
Right.
And I think the same about my home. Or, you know, I know that my family feels the same about their home, but somehow we suspend belief that that could be true of people who are coming into other countries. And it's really surprising to me that we can't empathize with those situations.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It is surprising. And it's, I don't know quite how we got here, because I'm not sure that we used to be that way. I mean, my perception is it's gotten worse in the last 20 years, 10 years. And part of that's because there are political movements that exploit the natural human fear and suspicion of the other that we all have, but they amplify it and they exploit it. And so that's definitely part of what's happening. And Christians, unfortunately, seem to be at least as susceptible as other people, and maybe more susceptible, because we have this long rhetoric of us versus them, or, you know, Christ against culture, or light against the darkness. We have that kind of rhetoric, and then that can be hijacked by somewhat unscrupulous people who exploit our fears of the other for their own advantage. And that's happening in Europe, right? Political parties have arisen. It's happened in the U.S. on steroids. And it's happening in other countries, too. And again, that's not accidental or some force of nature. I mean, there are people who work at this every waking moment to make this happen. So so Christians need to, we need to wake up a bit.
And I think being rooted in our biblical kinds of things that should guide us, and not the things in our culture or the outside influences. In Jesus, King of Strangers, you trace the major theme of migration as it develops throughout the narrative of Scripture. And you begin by looking at the stories of Abraham and Sarah. And I remember, I've been a Christian a long time, and it has always been in my mind that Abraham was terrible for saying that Sarah was his sister, and he wasn't brave, and he was all of these things. Like, I always read it that way. And then when I read your book, and you put it in context of really what were the fears of both Sarah and Abraham, because they were in a foreign land, and what they understood about what was happening and all of those things. It was just fascinating to me. And so tell us more about their stories and how that cultural identity is shaped based on Abraham and Sarah.
Backing up just slightly, it seems like if you read the Old Testament particularly, but in a lot of ways also the New Testament, there's this strong sense that we came from somewhere else, right? That even though that God promises this land and we're blessed to be here and we like to be here and all of that, we have another side of our story which involves our being somewhere else. And part of that is about the remote ancestors like Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebecca and Jacob and Leah and Rachel and Bill and Zilpah. We have to get them all in. And Joseph, who's a kind of secondary migrant, right? He leaves the migratory home for another migratory home, and then they come back. So part of that's about them. Part of it's about the Exodus, which is the major event in the Old Testament. But lurking in the background of all these texts is the experience of a series of deportations, the Assyrian and Babylonian exiles, if you want to call them that, where people were forcibly moved by states out of their homeland and resettled somewhere else for the economic and political interests of the state. And those kinds of stories are all over the place in the Bible. And I told my students the other day, I don't think that without those experiences of the Assyrian and Babylonian exiles, there would be a Bible. That those are such important events, or series of events, that without them we wouldn't have the text we have. You can hardly pick a page where they're not talked about in some way, either directly or indirectly. And I think the Abraham and Sarah stories and so on are partly reflecting that, at least in part. That depends on a series of things about when you date the text and stuff like that that we don't have to go into. They're not that crucial. But for Abraham and Sarah, these are the ancestors who are somehow like us. They're exemplars, right? I mean, that's how Paul reads them in Romans, or how Hebrews reads them. It's how early Christians read them. It's how Jews read them. These are, in some ways, exemplars, not in every possible way, right? You shouldn't cheat your old man by pretending to be your brother, right? That sort of thing. But in other ways, they're exemplars. And part of their exemplary status is that they're migrants. And you mentioned the story, this is Genesis 20, where Abraham for the second time tries to pass his wife off as his sister. I think if I were she, I would have said, could we have a different plan, please? But she didn't, somehow. And his justification is, when the king confronts him, he says, why did you lie to me? He says, well, this is a place in which there's no respect for God. even though in the story, the king, having been threatened by God, has said, okay, I'll take care of it. It's an interesting thing that Abraham's not entirely right about that. And the text doesn't say, let's commend his cleverness for pretending that Sarah's his sister. It just tries to highlight, in its economical way, it tries to say, let's take seriously the experience these people had. And I would think the readers, early, the ancient readers know this. They know this kind of reality. They experience it too sometimes. And they may laugh a bit. The story has a comic element, right? But also, it's very serious. They're afraid. And I think we see that in a lot of biblical stories. I mean, Jacob leaves his land. He thinks he's never coming back. He has to be told by God, I'll bring you back. I'll be with you. Which is a bit surprising since he's a con man, right? I mean, why in the world would God be with this guy? But he is. And on it goes, on and on and on it goes. God's protection of the migrant. Hope that helps some.
One of the things that's really interesting is you explore this dual nature of Israel's identity, that they're both migrants and they are supposed to understand themselves as a migratory people. And when they come into their own land, to be a host of migrants. And I think that's really encapsulated in Deuteronomy, where in chapter 26, they're commanded when they bring the tithes, they're supposed to recite their story. Like you were saying earlier, you know, we learn and we are able to grow through story. But they're supposed to tell this story that starts off, my father was a wandering Aramean. Basically, genetically, I am a migrant. The Lord brought us up out of Egypt with a mighty hand, outstretched arm. And then it says, when you give the tithe, you and the Levites and the foreigners residing among you shall rejoice. You're all to celebrate together as one people. They're to be a welcoming people for migrants. Can you speak a little bit to this dual nature of Israel being the migrant and host of migrants? And why was that so important to their self-understanding?
When you read Torah and also the prophets, they put together categories of vulnerable people, right? They put together widows and orphans and migrants. And they see the oppression of the migrant as the equivalent of the oppression of orphans and widows. In other words, it's a very sorry thing to do. It's not one of those things you have to spend time explaining why it's unethical. And you even have threats. I talk about this in the book, in Torah, that God threatens to slay with the sword the person who oppresses the migrant, which you hardly ever read in the Bible. You very seldom have threats. I know that people think that you do, expect that. But if you read Torah, the 613 commandments, how many of them have threats? I think you can name them on one hand. So it's quite rare. Why is that? Because when people are vulnerable and afraid, we tend to circle to our immediate family, protect ourselves and those we most love. And that means we're willing to run over other people. So the Torah forbids that. So that's the negative side. But the positive side is a text like you described, where you're remembering your other. And Aramean is not some neutral word anyway. These are the enemies, right? Aram, Damascus, and the kingdoms north of that are the Arameans. They're the enemies. So this is not like saying my family came from Scotland or Ireland, which mine did. This is a lot stronger than that. So the fact that we name it, we say they were pagans, and by the way, we need to stop being pagans, is pretty fundamental. It's very much the ancestor of the Christian notion, like in Ephesians, that we were all dead in trespasses and sin. It's that sort of thing. Yeah. We had a radically different identity, but we now have a different identity. And yet, I'm going to back away from that analogy because it's not like saying I used to be a sinner and now I'm not. I'm still an Aramean, and there's nothing wrong with that, and I keep remembering it. So it's an interesting thing. I want to be careful because I don't think that the biblical texts, you know, explore every detail of these sets of issues. And they don't all say the same thing. They have different views on some of the nuances. But they do have the basic commitment that the migrant is not really other. He or she is other, maybe, but not really, not at the deepest level. Mm-hmm. So we do have texts that invite migrants to the festivals, and we have others that are less, not quite as quick to do that. So they're not all on the same page exactly, but they're definitely in the same chapter. And so that's worth thinking about.
What are some of the other important teachings from the Torah that inform how Israel was to relate to migrants? Just thinking through like how that could also challenge us in the way that we relate.
Well, a couple of examples. If you think about the book of Genesis, how it's put together, there's a thread through it of a single family, right? Abraham and the names I gave earlier, the ancestors of Israel. But there are all these ancillary lines, right? Ishmael's line, Lot's line, Esau's line. And sometimes we frame those as kind of rejected people or outsiders or whatever. But if you read Genesis carefully, that's not true. They're not exactly us. They're not the bearers of the promise that we've been given, but they have their own promises and their own blessings. God cares about them. Take, for example, Genesis 36, which is a very obscure text, the genealogy of Esau. I've never heard a sermon on this text. I probably never will. And I'll never preach one, I'm sure. But when you read it, you hear about all these names and you think to yourself, why did Israelites care about this? Why on earth would you care about this? You hear about such and such a sister who married this person and this was the king who conquered this. And you're thinking, why? Who cares? But I think that Genesis wants to say, no, actually, these are our cousins. We should care. We should know something about this. We even hear who, again, Ishmael, the Ishmael genealogy. We hear about so-and-so's sister was so-and-so, as though the readers must know a story about that person, right? Mm-hmm. And we're trying to connect the dots. So that to me is interesting. There's this, on the one hand, there is an emphasis on election. Yeah, God chose the people of Israel, but that doesn't mean that God is uninterested in everybody else or that we should be. So that's one kind of really basic thing. So I guess just to summarize, I think you see the concern about the other, the outsider, the migrant, the stranger. It's probably unfortunate we translate the word as stranger when it's really migrant. But you see that concern in law and you see it in story. And it's probably worth thinking about both of those. And I think those both help Christians too. And the last part of that, it's not as though that this was a concern for those people and then the New Testament got rid of it or somehow became more spiritual, whatever that means. That's not the case. The apostles were migrants, right? You get James and 1 Peter addressing the church in the 12 tribes scattered abroad, Christ followers in diaspora. In Revelation, you get every language and tongue gathered around the throne of God in the city that dropped out of the sky, the heavenly Jerusalem that's come to earth. And on and on and on and on and on and on it goes.
Yeah, it's interesting talking about the laws in Torah of how many were designed for the provision of the foreigners. Like, yes, there's the chosen people, but it's a very porous boundary. If you want to become a Jew, you can become a Jew. Here's how you do that. Get circumcised, you obey the law, and you're to be treated just like anybody else. The gleanings of the field, you have a right to glean the fields that we see most poignantly in Book of Ruth. But they didn't do such a great job of following Torah. And so you have these words in the prophets, and you focus in chapter 7 a lot on the words of Jeremiah, who has a lot to say about a lot of the ways that Israelites missed the mark. One of the things you note is the temptation to allow the state, the empire, the nation, whatever, to determine human dignity or worth. How do you see Jeremiah addressing this tendency, and what does that say to us today?
Well, you know, Jeremiah is reacting to some very extreme conditions, right? The Assyrian Empire collapsed. It was replaced. I mean, there was this brief moment of celebration, like the book of Nahum, which seems to think, okay, Nineveh's fallen. It's going to be okay. And then it wasn't okay because here come the Babylonians. And so Jeremiah is reacting to this very extreme situation where people are being forcibly removed and made to leave the country, cities destroyed. And he tries to find language and actions that model hope, right? For example, his cousin, while the city is besieged, his cousin sends him a note saying, please buy my property. And God tells him, you're going to be told to buy the property, you should do it. And then he has this interpretation of the event, which is that the days will come when we will restore. The Babylonians are going to win. They're going to do enormous damage, but they're not going to get to determine the future entirely. Mm-hmm. And that's worth thinking about. I think that states do rise and fall. And I have some pretty strong preferences about how they work while they're surviving, right? I mean, I don't think that a stateless utopia is anywhere near our future. I mean, none of us will be alive to see that. We might see a stateless dystopia, you know, where a failed state, that's a really bad thing. So the state does have a role, and it's going to exercise that role somehow or another. But deep down, bureaucracies and governments, even the best governments, even the best run governments, can't decide what we are as human beings. I mean, that's actually a deeply Christian idea, and it's borrowed by modern democracies too. I mean, they borrowed this from Christianity. When a slaveholder called Thomas Jefferson says all men are created equal, there's a profound inconsistency in his own life, sure. Mm-hmm. But he's swiped this from Christianity, right? Mm-hmm. And that's fine. I'm glad. I'm happy for him to swipe it. But that's got to be our fundamental sense that, and that is in the prophets too, back to your question eventually, that the prophets kind of cut through the delusions that we all have and get to the point of, no, actually we stand before God. We are judged by God mainly on how we treat each other, and we should take that seriously. And yes, it's, you know, the God who judges us is also the God who died for us, as Paul says to the Romans, but that doesn't let us off the hook. That, if anything, makes our actions of injustice even more disgraceful and intolerable. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to add to that, Drew. I'm sorry. I feel pontification coming on, and I'm trying to resist.
I'm just hoping you'll burst into song like you did in class every once in a while.
That's what I'm waiting for. I get excited. I'm sorry. I'm a preacher. I can be really long-winded.
So, Mark, when we look at the early church and the ways that they tried to live out their call to follow Christ, you note that they embodied a culture of empathy. So what are some of the ways that they did that?
Well, there are a lot of things we don't know about the early church. And one of the reviewers of my book said I was too optimistic about the early Christians. But I can live with that, I think. That's fine. You know,
too optimistic.
Well, too sentimental, I think, was the word. And I think, you know, you got to be sentimental about something. Why not that? The early church, at least ideally, I mean, obviously, they didn't live up to their ideals any more than we do. I mean, we don't, mm-hmm. and we never will, probably. But it's fascinating to me. If you think about, for example, the end of Romans, you have this long list of names. I'm picking weird mm-hmm. text, I know, but the end of Romans, this long list of names. Paul says, greet this person, that person, this person, that person. People he had met somewhere else.
Yeah.
So he has a network, and he's a brilliant social entrepreneur and networker, right? Whatever else you say about him. He has this network of people who've kind of moved in and out of Rome, large Jewish community there, probably also some Gentiles maybe. But this network of people that have found homes with each other and have hospitality toward each other, even when they move from one big city to another, right? I think he met Aquila and Priscilla in Corinth, as I remember. But anyway, he'd met them somewhere else. And so, say hello to them, he says. So that's interesting, the networking that they're doing in the early church, that they do social networking in a way that's pretty different from most people. It probably has an ethnic core. I mean, most of them are Jews, but they also include Gentiles, and they help each other. So that's one thing. Another thought is, you think about the end of Hebrews. Hebrews has this line, which I do talk about in the book a bit. He says he's moved from this allegory of Jesus as the priest and the sacrifice and the temple and the veil in the temple and, you know, this interesting way of thinking about who Jesus is. And then he starts telling you, no, here's what you got to do. Here's how you live based on that. And one of the things he says is, don't forget to exercise hospitality or to entertain strangers, the old mm-hmm. King James Version says, because some people have entertained angels without knowing it. Now, that's a very weird reason to give for showing hospitality, right? A very strange text, if you think about it. But of course, he's talking about the Abraham and Sarah story, right? And the sense that, you know, the stranger who comes into your house may be, could just be an angel, maybe. I've never met anybody I suspected of being an angel. I've met a few people I suspected of being demons, but that's another totally different thing. But he says, you know, in other words, you as a follower of Christ, you live in a world of wonder. And sometimes very extraordinary things happen if you're open to them. And one of the ways of being open is through, I mean, we call it hospitality, but really it's philoxenia is the Greek word, the love of the stranger, the care for the stranger. And so you make sure that the person who enters your community in need is taken care of somehow. So that's a fundamental ethical commitment in Judaism and Christianity, indispensable commitment. So that's another interesting example. I'm sure the church didn't always do this right. I mean, you have instructions that if a prophet shows up and he stays more than 3 days in your home, he's not really a prophet. He's just a guy who wants a free meal. You know, you have things like that. But so it could be abused.
Yeah.
But the basic commitment is toward hospitality.
I'm not sure what the statistic is right now, but the percentage of foreigners or immigrants, refugees that are in the U.S. that have never been invited into an American's home is like so high, over 50% the last that I checked. And that to me, like when you're just talking about hospitality, like not even having someone in your home for days on end, but just inviting them in for a meal or to celebrate a holiday or whatever. It's just amazing to me how we have more believers than that in the U.S. and yet the statistic is still so high on how people are not being, you know, when they come from somewhere else, they're not being invited into our homes. It's unusual to me.
Yeah, and I worked with World Relief here in the Piedmont Triad of North Carolina, and Mark mentioned that narrow window of 3 months to get everything, your language training, figure out what all the resources are, try to find a job, and some of them figure out how plumbing and ovens work, and all that they're supposed to figure out in 3 months. And the biggest factor on whether they thrive or not is meaningful connections with other people. So we were highly encouraged to engage with them, have meals. And I tell you what, some of the best food I've ever eaten is because of the involvement there and having them in our house, having us in there. And it's an enchanted, like I think what Mark was saying about the entertaining angels, it has this kind of enchanted value to it of there is a mysterious element to the other that too often we're just afraid of instead of coming to it with open eyes and a childlike heart of, you know, what blessings are going to come out of this new relationship and getting to know these people. So anyway.
No, I think that's well said. And it's not that hard, right? I mean, you probably don't want to eat my cooking, but compared
I'll take Sam Jung's.
Well, yes, my wife's cooking. But compared to putting a person on the moon, hosting a dinner is not very hard. So I think this should be easier. I think this is a place where clergy can lead, can model, and you don't have to fall on every political sword laid out in front of you. You just need to invite people to dinner. And so I think that's a place to start, at least.
Yeah.
The major emphasis for Common Grounds is unity. And so what advice could you give our listeners, Drew and I, on how to challenge, how to be open? How do we move this issue forward so that as believers, we are living out what Scripture says about how we care for widows, orphans, and the stranger, the immigrant?
I think it's a hard question to answer because there's not a one-size-fits-all approach, right? I think part of it is we tell stories. I'll probably tell your story, for example, things you've been doing, because I think story helps people see other alternatives. And of course, we're being told stories all the time. If you're plugged into certain media outlets 24/7, as so many people mm-hmm. are, you're being yeah. told certain stories that sometimes are profoundly anti-Christian, even though they're pretending to be Christian.
Yeah.
And so telling stories, part of it, you know, laying out facts, studying the Bible together with people. I think it depends on the people. I know some people who are, you know, or the sort of people you're talking about, they're very upset about migration. They're scared, etc. But it's because they've been listening to this stuff and they really haven't thought about it very deeply, and the lizard brain is being tapped all the time. And you can say, do the kind of gentle conversations we just talked about, and stick with people, and they kind of get it. And I've seen that. It doesn't matter by age. In the book, I quote a woman who's was way, way up in her 80s at the time about her reaction to somebody in the church being deported. And she said, you know, she was quite indignant about this because she knew the family.
Yeah.
So it's not about age and it's not about education. It's about disposition toward the world. There are some people, on the other hand, who are deeply committed to a vision of the world in which the migrant is a threat. The brown folk are coming to taint our blood. That kind of rhetoric. The rhetoric I thought had been left in the 1940s mm-hmm. and Nazi Germany has resurfaced in our country. And so for them, I think you have to respond to them in the way you respond to somebody you love who's fallen into egregious sin. I'm going to say something that will irritate people. If somebody, a close relative or a dear friend had decided to chuck his marriage and shack up with somebody else, how would I treat that person? Or they've decided that, yeah, grand larceny is for me. You know, that's my lifestyle from now on. I mean, how would I treat that person? I wouldn't just dump them, but I also wouldn't pretend that there's no problem here. So how would I deal with that? And I'm terrible at that sort of thing, honestly, but I think to me that's a model. I've never heard people say that it's quite this way, and I understand it. That could really annoy people to hear me say that, but I don't see another way to look at it, honestly. I don't think you can, when people are committed to oppression as a style of life, you can't just be nice and pretend that, no, it's you know, I like chocolate ice cream and you like strawberry and we're all friends. It's not like that. Does that make sense?
And then but the hard thing is that there's so much emotion that it's even hard to have a conversation sometimes. Like, even if I'm trying to give information, it's just everything's so wrapped in emotion that it just shuts everything down. And then that's so frustrating because it is so important.
That's true. And it's not just, these are not just strangers, right? They're people we love and care about. I kind of think that my job is to persuade the people I can persuade and then let them persuade the people they can persuade and so on. I don't think I can persuade everybody, mm-hmm. at least not right away. And that bothers me because I think everybody should agree with me. But
or Drew.
Well, yeah, right. I agree. Yeah, we should. But it doesn't work that way. And I have to be able to just accept that. I can't always persuade. Jesus didn't always persuade. So why would I think mm-hmm. I could? Now, about the being taken advantage of and so on, we don't want to be. But we follow a Lord who went to the cross.
Yeah.
Right? So talk about being taken advantage of. So what are we talking about here? Right?
Yeah. It's like what Paul was saying, why not rather be taken advantage of? As a follower of Christ, I think it's much more appropriate for us to prefer being taken advantage of than being the persecutor. And we lose sight of that.
As Christians, we all think, we have different ideas of what this means, but we all think mm-hmm. that we stand before the judgment seat of Christ. In some sense, we're accountable to God, and we have to explain why we did what we did. And everybody knows about it, which is absolutely terrifying. Mm. Even though at the end he says, okay, it's okay. But that brief moment when everybody knows about it is absolutely horrifying.
Yeah.
And yet that's what we think. I mean, that's a core Christian belief. And so we should probably take that seriously.
And even more than persuade, what is there for us to do? Like, maybe from your experience, you know, in Abilene, Texas, what are some ways people can not just try to persuade others, but live into the kind of lifestyle that we see Scripture calling us towards.
Well, Abilene does a pretty good job of bringing in refugees. There are quite a number of folks from at least a dozen countries living in our little town. And there's a community of people who work with those folk and help them get going, get moving in life. Mm-hmm. And I think most of that involvement is like you talked about. We sit down to dinner. We have a conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe I know how to drive. I can help you learn how to drive. It's not rocket science, mostly. Or I've sat in the Social Security office. I can read the forms fluently, you know, and maybe you can't. I can help you. It's not, you know, I don't have to marry my child to your child next week, right? Maybe they will. Who knows? But I'm just saying it's not a huge commitment to help somebody navigate a system that's often quite unfriendly. I mean, bureaucracies can be very unfriendly, not necessarily intentionally, but they just are.
I like what you said about setting an example, and clergy can set the example, the idea of having a meal with someone. And so I think one thing that I'm going to take from this as a step I can take is those that I'm in relationship with who do have roles of leadership or influence in their churches, to encourage them to have dinner with someone from another culture and then share about that, like in their sphere of influence, because that really can be a powerful example. And so I really appreciate that idea. And so that's one thing I'm going to definitely do. So my friends who are listening to this podcast, be ready. I'm going to be calling you.
Good. That's wonderful. Awesome. Well, I think it's a hard time for clergy, right? We're seeing some people call it the great unchurching. We're seeing institutions retrench or disappear in some cases. And we're seeing Christians engage in behavior that's patently anti-Christian. And often the clergy bear the brunt of that, although some of them do that too. But so it's a hard time to be in ministry right now. It's always been hard, but there are dimensions of difficulty that haven't been around in my lifetime until the last few years. And you can put a political name on that and you can label it. It's pretty easy to label, but how do we get out of it? And I think finding ways that allow clergy to build some social capital and some courage, which I think is pretty short supply, would be helpful. And so if we can find some early victories, that would be nice. And so I think we can, as you say.
So we've talked a lot about some heavy things. You know, we're going to end with something that's just light and easy, and that is our lightning round. And so we're going to ask you some questions that don't have any eternal significance, so don't think too hard about them. All right, Drew, ask an easier one.
Okay. What's one subject that you would like to learn more about?
Well, there are a lot of things I'd like to learn. I used to say that when I retire, I want to take math courses. Actually, I think I would like to do that. I'd like to learn.
You really failed the lightning round. What in the world? Math?
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Well, I told you I was afraid of this round, actually. Because, I think that's it. Math. Let's stick with math. I want to learn math. All my relatives are math people.
Oh, gosh. Okay, if you had a free trip anywhere, where would you go?
A free trip anywhere? I would go to China, I think. I would take I would go down the Yangtze River on a boat and see all of that. And I would go to the tomb of the Terracotta Warriors. And I think I'd go there.
Okay.
So here's China. What I'd really like to know. If you could have any superpower, what would it be?
I think my superpower would be abolishing superpowers.
Math. He would like math to be his superpower.
Yeah, I'd like to be good at math. Yeah, that's right. They call him Algorithm Man or something like that. Have the Pythagorean theorem on your cape or something like that.
I remember you saying that your lifelong goal was to get to the point where you only spoke in footnotes.
Oh. Well, I've also said I wanted to be an opera singer. I mean, I have a lot of these crazy ambitions. spoke only in footnotes. I think I've almost gotten there, actually. I've made serious progress on that one.
Okay, one more for me. Given a choice, a night out or a night in?
Probably a night in. Yeah, I think my wife would enjoy a night in more, too. So probably a night in. Yeah. Is he a nerd? Yes, we've proven that. We've demonstrated this amply. So.
All right. This last question before Tina closes us out. Other than Jesus, who inspires you?
Oh, a lot of people inspire me, actually. Dorothy Day inspires me, founder of the Catholic Worker Movement.
Yeah.
Dietrich Bonhoeffer inspires me. Mm-hmm. I think Desmond Tutu inspires me. And there's a long list, actually.
I've seen a theme.
Yeah, I imagine. One of my scholarly inspirations is, this is more obscure, is a fellow named Henry Cadbury, who's the only biblical scholar to give an acceptance speech for the Nobel Peace Prize. And he did it because he was chair of the American Friends Service Committee for many years, and one of the founders. And the Friends won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1947. And so a man who could do serious scholarship and also work for peace, I think, That's an inspiration. That's a name that most people won't know. Most biblical scholars won't even know. He's been dead a long time. But anyway, I think that's a person.
Cool. I think I'll be looking him up after we get off this podcast.
Yeah, it's the same Cadbury like the candy. He's a distant cousin of theirs somehow. Mm. Anyway.
Mark, thank you so much for taking time with us today and just sharing your intellect and your sense of humor and your love for scripture. And we really appreciate your time and your work. And when you get done with your next book, we would love to have you back on.
My wife and I wrote a book together, and it's coming out in April. So I don't know, Drew, if you took the course that she and I taught. We taught this course over and over again, and we've said we need to write a book, and we finally did, and it's finally coming out. So for what that's worth. But anyway, thank you both. Thank you both for the chance to talk, and I appreciate all you're doing.
We have a vision to create and support gatherings of unity-minded Christians around the globe. Imagine the good news of these gatherings modeling the prayer of Jesus in our divided world. Don't forget, if you're benefiting from this ministry, then please consider a monthly donation to www.commongroundsunity.org/donate. Thanks so much for being part of Common Grounds Unity, and we encourage you to have a cup of coffee with someone that is not from your particular denomination or faith group and get to know each other, because unity starts with a cup of coffee.
Thank you for listening to the Common Grounds Unity podcast. Please check out commongroundsunity.org to learn about who we are and to find gatherings in your area. You can also subscribe to our monthly digital newsletter, join the Facebook group, or find our YouTube channel. If you benefit from this ministry, please consider a monthly donation by going to www.commongroundsunity.org/donate. Until next time, God bless, and remember, unity starts with a cup of coffee.